Okay, at this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday Night Speakers Meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend a group conscious meeting. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim Powers. My sobriety date is February 18, 2002. I come to every group conscious meeting except one or two during the wintertime where I'm up in the woods. And about 2 minutes before this meeting, I was asked to chair. So, and what I've been taught by my sponsor is you don't say no to AA. And we had a little, my name is not Maria, so if you look up there, that's not me up there as the chairperson for the month. There was a little dilemma with the speaker tonight, and what we do at Central, you know, I'm not even going to talk about my story because I don't, you know, y'all have heard it enough. I was a drunk. I couldn't stop drinking. I came here. I almost killed myself trying to prove I could, and I finally got a sponsor, worked the steps, and my life is just unbelievably fantastic today. So if you don't have a sponsor, really, that's the main thing that I want somebody to hear tonight is to get a sponsor. But our chair people, when they volunteer to chair Saturday Night Speaker or other meetings, they always have a backup plan. And the backup plan tonight was that the speaker was supposed to be here. They had some other commitment. They couldn't be here. So the chairperson is going to be our speaker tonight. And I've heard her speak before. I love her a lot. And please welcome Maria.
Well, hello there. My name is Maria, and I am an alcoholic. Wow. I don't know what I'm going to say. I only have my story. That's the only story I could tell, my story. And I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful that that I'm sober and alive. And those two things go together for me. It's my story. My sobriety date is July 18, 2004. And wow, lately I've been very emotional every time I remember the date of my sobriety. It's pretty much a miracle. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and how it is now. And I could tell you that I was born into a dysfunctional family. I grew up in an abusive household. There was physical abuse, verbal abuse, spiritual abuse, and sexual abuse. And that's not what makes me an alcoholic. You know, I justify a lot of my drinking by the past and what my parents did and what everybody else did, and it took a while before I could recognize that I needed to be responsible for myself. And it wasn't until I got into these rooms that I had to look at myself in the mirror and say, you know what? It's over. You can't blame mom and dad. It's on you from now on. And that's pretty much what started my recovery in this program. And I cannot say that my dad is an alcoholic, but I could tell you that because of his drinking, our life was very disruptive. And my parents got divorced when I was very young. And because of his many attempts on my mother's life, he got us by default when it was time for the divorce and the custody hearing. So I grew up with a person that had a problem drinking. And because of that, we moved around a lot. We moved around every year. And my dad, you know, he tried to do better by us. You know, he said, well, let's go to the States. You'll have opportunities there, and you get to learn a new language. And he tried. Well, once again, because of his drinking, we ended up homeless. And in the end, I ended up in foster care for 2 years with my brothers and sisters. And once again, I thought that if you had the life that I live, you know, that you would drink too. Because I used to drink a lot over the past because I couldn't change it. And I had a problem with the God idea because I felt that if there was a God, he wouldn't allow the things that happened to have happened. But today I recognize that that I'm not a victim anymore. I'm a survivor. And this program makes it available, you know, to have that kind of attitude change. I have to say I'm nervous, so hopefully I'll stop shaking and my accent will become less pronounced. And that's okay. One of my sponsors says, you know, when you get nervous like that, it's just God shaking the truth out of you, and it's going to be all right. You know, So we moved to the States, got in foster care. My mom came from Puerto Rican and got us. And I could tell you that I've lived in the best neighborhoods and I've lived in the worst neighborhoods. And in the end, I lived in a in one of the bad neighborhoods. And I grew up thinking that grew up where I come from, you know, we fight until we die. That's pretty much the attitude I was raised with. You know, you're just hard, you know, and you don't see them crying. You know, you don't show them that you're upset. It's just tough all the time and stuff like that. And I could tell that the first time I had a drink, I was 9 years old, and I could still feel it, feel the heat when it hit the back of my throat, the stomach, and just that feeling of everything was going to be okay. And it took a while before I was able to chase that feeling once again. It wasn't until I got into college. And I always thought there was something wrong with me. I, you know, in high school, I hang out with the jocks and played a lot of sports. But then I was in drama, so I was an actress, you know, and then did academic Olympics. So I was with the people that study hard and just change. You know, I was just that person that changed with the circumstances. And my surroundings. I became that chameleon the Big Book talks about. And I actually thought that the problem with me was I lacked discipline, you know, that moving around, I need some stability. So I ended up going to military college because I felt that I needed structure in my life, but it took a while for me to realize I didn't like to be told what to do. So, you know, it's tough, and I figured out, you know, drinking became the thing to do in school. I thought it was on. You know, I was proud of the fact that I could drink most guys under the table, and I lived for that. That was my, you know, my badge of honor, basically. After 3 years of military school, I knew that that I needed to quit because I didn't like being told what to do, and my drinking had become more important. So I quit, and I went out into the world and went and got a job. And I was always attracting people that drank like me, so I never saw that my drinking was a problem. Because I consider myself a social drinker. I just didn't realize what an overachiever I was, you know, until much later, you know. When the 9-step promises I read, I always felt that that's what alcohol did for me. The fear of people, the fear of talking to somebody, you know, it would go away. I wasn't afraid of the bills or whatever the case might be. You know, alcohol made all of that go away. And it worked for me. And I lived to drink. And drink made it bearable for me to live the life that I lived. You know, and I was surrounded by people that lived like I did and drank like I did, so I just didn't see a problem with it. And I started drinking because it was fun. Because it is. It was a lot of, you know, the party was on. And it went on for a couple of years, and there were no, I don't know, hard things that would happen after my drinking until they started happening. And I would get home and I couldn't remember how I got there. I would wake up in my car and I would wake up in my bed. I'm like, whoa, where's the car? You know, and then all the stuff, you know, all the stuff started happening. You know, I woke up next to people and have to introduce myself after the fact, not before. And so I kept thinking that I needed to slow down, and I didn't have to drink every day, but once I did, it was off to the races with me, and it became like a Russian roulette. I picked up that one drink, and I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I didn't know where I was going to wake up, and I started waking up with this fear, you know. I'm like, whoa, where am I? Who's he? What's going on? What's my car? Going on? Let's go. And always with kind of panic and anxiety because I just didn't know what was going to happen. And I could stop for a while. I was proud of the fact that I could stop drinking, so that was the other thing. I didn't know that, that because I was not a daily drinker, I was basically a binge drinker, and I couldn't just have one. And I used to joke about that all the time with my friends. Hey, Maria, how much did you have last night? I'm like, one. The never-ending one. Because, you know, because it was just a cycle, you know. The waitress knew to keep it coming. And there were three things that needed to happen. I ran out of money, I passed out, or I left, you know. And the places that I drank at the beginning were very pretty. At the end, they weren't. Holes in the wall, you know. And And I thought that everybody lived the way that I did, and probably the way I did. You know, I worked hard, I lived hard, I played hard. And I would start out in the evening, have a couple of beers, then pick up a friend, go play some pool. Then we go dancing, and after that place, we go after our place, and after that, after our place, at the after our place, and so forth and so on. And before you know it, after our place was 10 o'clock in the morning, and this is the time I was coming home to go to sleep and do it all over again that night. And I don't know, the repercussions of my drinking just started getting worse. The boyfriend of the night before was upset that I wasn't dating him that night, and he broke the windshield and kept losing the car, kept getting the ticket, the car gets towed, and on and on and on and on, you know. And I'm like, man, I need to slow it down. And I would stop for a while, you know. I was proud of the fact I would stop for 3, 6 months, 9 months, and then, you know, slowly I'll say, you know, it's okay, let's go, you know, let's go. And everybody likes going, like going partying with me, because I was the type that I was the social coordinator. You know, my friends like, yeah, Andrea, you know, that guy over there. I'm like, girl, I got this. Hey, you know, my friend, you know, she wants to know you, but I don't know your name, and I need to introduce you. And before the end of the night, you know, I had all my friends hooked up. I had a round of drinks. I was paid off for the night. I didn't have to worry about my drinking. Taken care of, you know, and it was all good. But then, you know, things started getting ugly. You know, the baby mama drama, the windshield, the car, the police. And, you know, for the grace of God, I never got stopped. I was proud of the fact that I could drive everybody home, then get myself home, you know, or wake up in the car, you know. And then I had the bright idea. I was like, you know what? The problem, it's New York. This 24-hour town is going to kill you. You got to get out of here. It's the cops. It's the thieves. It's everybody. It's all these boyfriends, you know. So I moved to Florida because I'm like, no, I come down here 3 or 4 times a year, and it's always good, you know. So I said to myself, you know what, let's move to Florida. It's going to be okay. And I did, and everything was okay for a little while. And got the job, started working nights. The only thing open at that time was Walmart and Denny's when I got out of work. But once again, I'm a magnet for people that drink like me, so we got out of work at 4 o'clock. We'll be partying in the parking lot until the sun came up. It was time to go home. Party was over. You know, and once again, you know, the repercussions for my drinking. You know, I would wake up in my bed in a panic because I could not remember how I got home. Panic because I had to go looking for that car. Panic because I had to go check that car to make sure I hadn't killed anybody the night before, hit anything, and that the car was in one piece. And I don't know about you, but I just started getting scared. I'm like, man, this is not good. And to be honest, the pain of my drinking became greater than the pain of the joy of living. Basically, that's pretty much what happened. I started having suicidal thoughts. I just didn't care anymore. I thought it was the job that I had chosen and the career that I had gone into. I thought I was just going postal. You know, because I was suicidal and homicidal at the end. And I didn't recognize that I was hitting bottom. When I fill up my car, it reminds me that my tank is on empty, and I didn't want to stop. It was killing me, and I didn't want to stop. You know, I started making these rules for my drinking. I couldn't drink if I was angry, because I'll turn to the Jerry Springer Show. I started wanting to throw fun. Start throwing furniture around and starting fights with my sisters and stuff like that. And I couldn't drink if I was depressed or sad, because it just made it so much worse that I couldn't get up in the next day. I couldn't get out of bed. And that was, you know, the end was near. I didn't know. I had some family difficulties, and I would say that planning to kill my dad, and was in the midst of doing the deal, buying the gun and all this stuff. And I started doing that fossil prayer. I started asking God to kill me or send me some help. Kill me or send me some help, I would say all the time. The pain was just amazing. And I couldn't, the alcohol stopped working for me. It stopped working for me. It was making everything worse. My life was no longer bearable. I just wanted to die when I woke up. And I didn't know how much longer I could go on. I started having episodes of road rage. In the end, I tried to do the responsible thing and get a designated driver, because I still thought that I could still do it. And justify my drinking, I would drive this person back home and then drive home in a blackout. And I would say, you know, if you're out there, when I'm out there, you deserve what you get. That was my attitude. And for the grace of God, I didn't kill anybody out there. There was a birthday party. Somebody from work invited me to their birthday party, and I brought a gallon of rum, and I proceeded to drink half of it. And I can't remember the next couple hours, but when I woke up, you know, I didn't have a shirt on. My shirt was on the floor, we throw up all over it, and I proceeded to put the shirt on and drive home in a blackout. You know, and having to face people at work, that was, there's no amount of drinking that, that helps the shame and the guilt. But I actually did it, and that party was in March. I didn't get sober until July. So I was still fighting with the idea that I could do it by myself. And I said, you know, God, I just can't do this. Whatever's up there, just help me. And I'm grateful that my job has an employee assistance program. That week somebody came and made a presentation. And I said, okay, well, if this is what you got, I'm going to try it, and if not, I'll do my way. Ended up in a therapist's office and having all these problems and issues. And she says to me, you know, Maria, those homicidal thoughts and situations you have, and I think that the best thing for you is to move away from your family until we could get you better. And I had no problem with that. But when she said, you know, Maria, you might have a problem with alcohol and you might need to stop drinking, my attitude was, whoa, Nelly, let's not do anything drastic now. You know, we can't do that, you know. And because, you know, even though it wasn't working, that's the only solution I had, you know. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know I was suffering from alcoholism. And the way that I dealt with my alcoholism was by drinking, because I had no other solution until I got here. And it was not an easy deal. You know, I always think that the biggest obstacle to my recovery is myself. I got to look for a mirror and look at the person that's responsible for whatever difficulty I'm having. You know, and I was able to move away from the family. I was able to give up the family because in the end, I thought that they were most of the problem, you know, and alcohol had become more important to me than any relationship I had. You know, I remember when I was looking back on my sexual inventory and being in a relationship, and the boyfriend at the moment would say, you know, Maria, why can't we just hang? Why do you have to drink when we're together? Why can't we just chill? I say, it's okay, baby. And I would end the relationship and move on. You know, nobody came between me and my alcohol. And for that therapist to tell me that that might be my problem, I was like, whoa, let's not go there. I'm not ready. And then she challenged me. And it wasn't what she said, but what I heard. You know, what I heard was, I bet you don't pay for any alcohol until the next session. What she said is, I challenge you to not drink until the next time I saw you. And I had a side job working, and this guy bought me a beer, and how could I hurt his feelings, you know, by turning him down? He seen me drinking of beers, you know, and later on in the week, I had a jazz concert going with one of my friends, and she wanted to have a glass of wine, but I wasn't drinking. How could I deprive my friend, you know, her glass of wine? Because she didn't want to drink by herself, and she was paying. You know, so, you know, just had a couple of glasses of wine at the jazz concert. And then we had some company coming over on a Friday night or whatever, and I was the DJ and the bartender in the house. So how can I serve drinks? You know, quality control, I got to taste them so they go forward, you know? So I go back to that therapist and say, you know, I didn't buy any liquor. She's like, that wasn't the challenge. The challenge was for you not to drink. I said, so my attitude was, I got mad. I really did. I got sober. I stopped drinking on a resentment because she said I couldn't do it. And God help her, you know. And so I stopped drinking, and I was like, no matter what, I'm not going to pick up. At this time, I had already bought a house. I went down to Puerto Rico to, like, just take it easy. And everywhere I went, oh, my God, people greeted me with my favorite drinks. My aunt greeted me with 2 6-packs. You know, the thing is that my God has a sense of humor, because for me, this was my hell on earth. Nobody ever bought me drinks anywhere when I was on vacation. And wherever I went, I mean, the place where I was staying, they bought me a case of my favorite beer. And I was like, I made a promise, can't do this. You know what? Person that came up with the two, I was like, oh, I'm on medication. Then I ended up at this party where, I mean, it was alcohol galore and... and condiments included. And I do not share about drugs, not because I cannot share about it, because I never did them. The fallacy of my thinking was that I have drug addicts in my family. And you see them people under the influence of drugs, that is some scary ass. They can't control themselves, and I wasn't going to go there. I chose something that was legal. I chose something that I could control. And... And the thing was that at that time I didn't have a program. I called somebody in the States and I said, hey, you don't understand. I made a promise that I wasn't going to take a drink, but here I am at this party and they offered me. And you know, this person didn't have a program. She was one of us, and she says, it's okay, just have one. A person that drinks like me cannot have one. It's the never-ending one. And hung up the phone. I prayed. I said, get me out of here. Help me out of this, and I made it back. I mean, I came back to the States, and I couldn't believe it that I had managed to go on vacation. Because, you know, for me, vacation is is drinking nonstop. You know, I don't have to worry about having an appointment. I don't have to go to work. I could just have whatever I want, you know. And this vacation was just challenging, to say the least, because because it wasn't fun. It really wasn't fun. I was the type of drinker that if I was watching a game, I had to have a beer. If I was having pizza, I did everything with alcohol, you know. And coming back, he had suggested a meeting. That became my first home group. Saturday morning, 10 a.m., women's group. I thought I was a part-time alcoholic. I didn't think I had this full-time problem. So I said, you know what, I don't need to drink every day. I don't drink every day, so I'll go to a meeting once a week because I have a part-time problem. I started hearing things about AA, you know, the stuff about being a cult and stuff. So I said, no, I need to go to the library and do some research. I didn't buy a big book. I want to check one out, you know. And I sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked the steps off the wall. I sponsored myself. You know, awesome, awesome, awesome. You know, awesome work. Still disgruntled, still homicidal, still suicidal, still very angry. And I just sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for quite a while, you know, for quite a while. And I think from July until, like, you know, I wouldn't talk to you because I didn't want to waste your time or my time, because I was just doing research and I just don't want this commitment deal, you know. And I could not relate to the person that was chairing me, because, you know, she was white, you know, she was married, she had kids, you know, she ain't from New York, she ain't from the Bronx, she's not a Yankee fan, and on and on and on, you know. I just kept, you know, she's not a twin, you know, and just keep going down the line, you know. And so I couldn't relate, and I saw people drinking coffee, and I thought that the secret was the coffee. There's something in the coffee. So I started drinking coffee. I was still angry. I would sit around the rooms and make a hit list of people I wanted to kill. And the first person on that list, she was always happy. Always sharing her gratitude for being sober and yada, yada, yada. And yada, yada, yada. And the second person was always crying. You know, this is like drama. You know, this is soap opera. So I kept coming back every week to make sure that she was still happy and the other was still crying. You know, that's and taking more names on my list, you know. Later on, when I got sober, the first person on that list became my sponsor, and that second person became a grand sponsor of mine, you know, and that's not my deal. So power greater than myself. And I have to say that those women love me until I learned to love myself, and I still keep up with the challenge. And I thought that my problem was the social deal. So the gratitude bank was coming up. I bought a ticket, and I said, you know, if I survive this, I don't have a problem. You know, my God has a sense of humor. So he makes the postal worker, another postal worker, sit next to me. So brings me the message of AA, and she basically took the time. You know, she wasn't patting me on the back and saying, it's okay, you're going to be all right. Because the thing is, you know, where I come from, or if you're like me, you know, when you say, hey, I love you, you know, my translator is saying, I hate your guts, you know, and stuff like that. So it's very hard to take. You know, but this person, you know, she talked like where I come from, and she strongly suggested that that I get off the fence. You know, she says, you know what, you're sitting on the fence. And it's not really what she said, but what I heard, because she's like, you know, if you're one of us, you do what we do. We go to meetings, we get a sponsor, we work the steps, and by the time I see you next Saturday, you have gone to 3 meetings. Because my thing is, no, I work nights, and I kind of, you know, and she's like, no. Meetings happen any given deal, any given time. You find yourself, go get a literature, go do this, go do that. 3 meetings next Saturday. And if you're not one of us, get off that chair. You're taking up space and you're taking up room. This is life or death we're dealing with. You know, and if you're not ready, you're not ready. You know, and every birthday, I get to call this person and thank them for my sobriety, because they basically saved my life. Because I know that my army of one mentality, you know, was going to get me killed. Me sponsoring myself, you know, no experience, you know. The more I'm talking to the idiot, you know, that's pretty much it. Overqualified, you know, and I'm grateful for that, because I didn't go to 3 meetings. I was scared of this person, because she talked like the people from, you know, I went to 4. I said, I need bonus points. I need brownie points. I can't, you know, I could tell you that the best thing about getting sober is getting to feel again, and the worst thing about getting sober is getting to feel again. And that was one of the reasons I drank. I couldn't handle my feelings. And I remember one time we were hanging out. We went out to a meeting, you know. And I laughed so much that night that I got a headache from laughing. I have never felt that much joy sober. And, you know, the first thing in sobriety, you know, just the joy of being sober and not having to pick up a drink or whatever's going on in my life. Good, bad, and different. I think by coming into the rooms of AA that I have found that there is a solution. It's read at most meetings when they read how it works. You know, once I worked the steps, my life not only got different, it got better. Obviously, I'm out here, so I didn't kill anybody. I'm still alive, so no longer suicidal. And I'm grateful. I will sound like that one of my sponsors who basically said I could never repay the debt. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life, because I wasn't living. You know, I don't think that was living. Today I have dreams. Before I didn't think it was possible to do the stuff I've been able to do, and. You know, the service, for me, it's one of the things that keeps me sober and keeps it real for me. I take a meeting to detox because I sometimes forget what this disease looks like, and I need to look at it live. I need to know that that it still kills. I've gone to a funeral of somebody that passed away because of this disease, and one of the blessings of this program is that whenever you're going through something, there's somebody else in the room is going through the same thing. And if you're lucky enough, you go through it together. And if you're not, you know, it's one of those deals. If I wasn't working the program right. Because, you know, to me it's not about time. It's about the quality of my recovery program. Some days I do better than others. And there was a time in my sobriety that I got in big trouble. There was this secret, and I had a sponsor and had a professional in my life, and things were not looking very well, and it became a ticking bomb, and I became so depressed. And I'm grateful for the fact that the Big Book talks about, you know, you need outside help, go get it. Ended up having to work the steps with somebody else, having to get another professional, and things got better. Just the part about being willing, you know, because that first sponsor, I didn't know her from a hole in the wall, and I thought she was stalking me at meetings, because we kept turning up at the same meetings all the time, and I think I was challenging God to show me the program, and I said, well, I'm going to pick her, because I ain't got nothing in common with her. But the fact is that she had the experience of working this 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she led me through the steps. And the bonus was she also took me through the traditions. And I'm grateful. I've had more than one sponsor in my 7+ years of sobriety, and I've learned different things from each person. And I remember several years ago I had this sponsor that I had over 20 years, and I asked her a question, and she told me she didn't know. I kind of lost it. I'm like, in my head, I was like, what? What do you mean you don't know? You got 20 years. What do you mean? You can't. What do you mean you're saying you don't know, you know? And the thing was that by her saying, I don't know, it gave me the freedom not to know everything. Because where I come from, you know, if you don't know it, you better make it up. You better do something. You cannot let them see you sweat. You know, that kind of deal. And I'm grateful for my sponsors today, because not only for the work that we do, but for the fact that they take the time and they show me how to do it. You know, I get to witness them working the program in their lives. And there's been some difficulties in my life, you know, and I wouldn't be able to know how to handle it unless I have come to these rooms, unless I see other people doing it, you know, so that three things. I don't know. I was wrong. Wow. Can't remember the third. Help. Four-letter words. That's what got it all. Help. Help me. That's what got me into these rooms and got me into the road of recovery. I am not responsible for my alcoholism, come to learn, but I am responsible for staying on the path. I'm responsible for my recovery. You know, one of the things I've learned is that it's easy for me to appear hard, but it's hard for me to appear soft and pathetic and sympathetic and all that. But I have learned how to do that in these rooms. Service work is a big part of my program today, because, like I said, I need to see that my disease is still alive and kicking. And today, you know, there is nothing I can think of. You know, I went up to New York a couple of weeks ago. My aunt is she's dying of cancer, and I just, you know, I just didn't know how to handle it. But it's been coming here and seeing the women as an example, other alcoholics that do the walk, not just the talk, that shows me to be a woman of integrity on display and be able to bring something forth, you know, not the drama, you know, and allowing my family to be themselves and able to live life, even that when I'm feeling pain, I don't have to pick up a drink over it, you know. My life is beyond my wildest dreams, you know. There's a lot of changes going on. And I get disgruntled sometimes because things are not going my way, and I feel that I need to know. And I forget that God is not on the bench, but He's taking care of the things that I've asked Him to take care of. And I need to sit back on the bench and let Him take over. My best ideas got me into AA. In the beginning, I was told that my mind is like a dangerous neighborhood. I cannot go there alone. So when I get to thinking, I got to pick up the phone and call somebody and tell them my great idea so I won't get in trouble, you know. And that's the thing, you know. Today I am grateful because I celebrated a birthday recently, and I got to travel to Hawaii, and I'm afraid of heights, but I got to go skydiving. I'm afraid of deep water, but I got to learn how to scuba dive. And I'm not saying this stuff to show off or anything like that. It's just to tell you that miracles do happen. There is a God of my understanding, and He's in charge, and it's not me. And whenever I take charge, you don't want to see the mess I make. You know, I got to get out of the habit of calling my sponsors after, not before I get those great thoughts and actions. Because I sometimes get into those, and I will talk about my mentors for a minute here. You know, like I talked earlier about being on taking some action and trying to buy a gun and all this. For the last couple of years, I've been going down to Puerto Rico to visit my dad and celebrate his birthday. If that is not a higher power, I don't know what is. He's going to be 90 in January. And, you know, I think this is the third or fourth year that I go down there. This stuff works. I didn't think that the resentment could be transformed to somebody that, for me to act like a daughter, a loving daughter, no matter what happened in the past or what he did or what not happened. And I used to work for the homeless in New York, and last Thanksgiving I had a pity for my sponsor, because I think she was tired of hearing about the fact that I needed to make amends, and I needed to make amends to this place I used to work at, because they didn't recognize how great I was. So I permanently borrowed some things. You know, they call that stealing in some circles, but I permanently borrowed some things, and I had an accident, I couldn't walk, and I was praying for the willingness to be willing to make the amends. So the morning before I was supposed to leave, I got the courage, and I said, I can't go back to Florida without making this amends. My sponsor is going to, what she's going to do, you know? And so I went to the homeless shelter, and I asked to speak to the person in charge. And I used to be a security guard, and this lady's giving me the runaround. She said, here, take the phone number, call, make an appointment. I'm like, you don't understand. I don't live here. And she's giving me the runaround, and I'm like, I'm starting to ask for ex-co-workers of mine. And one of them shows up, and hey, you know, just here to visit, you know. And she's like, hey, hold on, Wanda will get you in, you know. And Wanda used to drink, would go out to drinking with me, and we used to drink alike. What I didn't know was, you know, back then Wanda was a social worker. What I didn't know was that Wanda had become the person that was in charge of the place now. So Wanda shows up, and I say, hey, Wanda, you think I could talk to you for a minute? And I basically say, I don't know if you're familiar with 12-step work, but when I worked here, I abused my position of power, and I took some things that did not belong to me. How can I make it right? I cannot give you the money. Even though that will be easy for me, but that's not what this is about. What can I do? So she says, we have 92 families. That's the concept. The children bring, buy some gloves, buy some scarves, buy some hats. So I jump on the subway, go downtown, go down to the warehouse, pick up a couple of boxes. You know, all my old co-workers were there meeting me when I got back and stuff like that, and they were very happy to see me. There's some people that I used to drink with. So we're on a different page now, and it's all good. You know, the thing about making amends is the fact that that shame and the guilt, it just goes away. I get to look at people in the eye and no longer feel that I'm not a part of. I am a part of this. You know, greatest feeling is that I thought that Wanda didn't understand how grateful I was for the opportunity to make the amends. She was grateful for the gloves and the hats and the scarf. I was grateful for that freedom of the shame and the guilt. I drank over and over and that today I don't have to drink over it, you know. I heard somebody say one time that this program gives you a mulligan, a do-over, you know, and that's the best thing I have been shown, you know, that I used to tell my nephews that I would be there to take them to the park and I would take that drink on Friday night, Sunday night would happen. I forgot about them. Drinking had become more important to me, and today my family wants me around. They ask for me and say, hey, when you're coming up, we want to spend some time, and, you know, it's a high-class problem. People want you around now. And today, if I tell them I'm going to be there, I better damn well be there. It's one of the things that this program has shown me, and I am grateful that it's been my coming here that I've gotten a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I'm going to end my with a reading from the Big Book, When I Forget What It's All About. God willing, we members of AA may never again have to deal with drinking, but we have to deal with sobriety every day. How do we do it? By learning through practicing the 12 steps and through sharing at meetings, how to cope with the problems that we look to booze to solve back in our drinking days. For example, we are told in AA that we cannot afford resentments and self-pity, so we learn to avoid these festering mental attitudes. Similarly, we rid ourselves of guilt and remorse as we clean out the garbage from our minds through the fourth and fifth steps of our recovery program. We learn how to level out the emotional swings that got us into trouble, both when we were up and when we were down. We are taught to differentiate between our wants, which are never satisfied, and our needs, which are always provided for. We cast off the burdens of the past and the anxieties of the future, as we begin to live in the present one day at a time. We are granted the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, and thus lose our quickness to anger and our sensitivity to criticism. Above all, we reject fantasizing and accept reality. The more I drank, the more I fantasized everything. I imagined getting even for hurts and rejections. In my mind's eye, I played and replayed scenes in which I was plucked magically from the bar where I stood nursing a drink and was instantly exalted to some position of power and prestige. I lived in a dream world. AA led me gently from this fantasizing to embrace reality with open arms, and I found it beautiful. For at last, I was at peace with myself and with others and with God. Thank you for keeping me sober today.